Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Time now for Science Out of the Box. This week, how the urge to return a landscape to its pristine state can be misguided. Billions of dollars have gone to restoring degraded American rivers to what's supposed to be their natural form. Often the goal is to recreate a river that curves back and forth, winding beautifully. But according to a new study, the idea that a meandering river is natural may be flawed. NPR's John Nielsen met the authors of the new study near a winding creek in rural Pennsylvania.
We're on the banks of the Little Conestoga Creek, which flows into the main Conestoga, and we're going to walk along the right bank of the stream.
Geologist Robert Walter used to think the Little Conestoga was about as natural as a creek can get. It's beautiful, it's tree-lined, and it winds past tall soil embankments that look like they've been around for thousands of years. In short, this is just the kind of stream that river restoration experts like to use as a model in this part of the East. But then, about 5 years ago, geologist Dorothy Meritz, who's married to Robert Walter, started finding strange objects buried in some of the tall banks that line this stream. For example, stumps of giant swamp trees cut by European settlers.
We also find log roads that early settlers built to get across these marshy bottomlands. They would cut down some of the younger trees, tall, straight trunks, and lay them out in a row and lash them all together.
Those finds made it look like Little Conestoga Creek had changed a lot over the past few hundred years. To find out more, Robert Walter took a bunch of soil samples and then ran tests that were designed to tell him whether the riverbanks were really as ancient as they looked. He says it turns out that there is nothing at all ancient about big dirt embankments like the one we are now facing.
Everything that you see, basically from my ankles to about 20 feet above us, was deposited between 1730 and 1850, about 120 years.
In other words, whatever this stream used to look like is now buried under 20 feet of mud. And in retrospect, Walter thinks it's obvious where all this mud came from. 300 years ago, it started washing down off of deforested hillsides and farm fields, he says. Then it started pooling up behind small dams colonists had built to power local grist mills. We found one of those early dams nearby. A winding creek flowed over the top of it and fell 10 feet into some rocks.
What they did initially was probably build a timber crib structure and maybe fill that with sediment. And then as time went on, they reinforced it with limestone, the Conestoga limestone.
Walter says more than 60,000 of these dams were turning eastern rivers into mill ponds by the end of the 1840s. But by the beginning of the 1900s, most of the ponds behind the dams were full of mud, and the dams themselves were abandoned or destroyed. In the journal Science, Walter and Dorothy Meritz argued that this is when a lot of supposedly natural winding rivers actually got their start, by cutting deep channels down through the leftover mud. Walter and Meritz teach geology at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. They say the story of what happened at Little Conestoga Creek shows how quickly people can forget what natural landscapes used to look like. Other river experts, like David Montgomery of the University of Washington, say the study is also a cautionary tale for everyone involved in the art of river restoration. He says the basic message of this paper is that if you want to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, you need to know exactly what he looked like in the first place.
If you're trying to restore rivers to benefit fish or other organisms in those rivers, if you're not just trying to make them look pretty, the best model for that is the system in which they evolved and thrived.
Back in Pennsylvania, Robert Walter says the landscape under the Little Conestoga was probably full of swampy streams that split off into lots of little twisted channels. He says wetlands like this were probably found all over the East Coast at one time. Excavating them will not be easy. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
When you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. But what if they can't see you? What if they can just hear you? New study out of the University of Portsmouth in the UK says that a smile is in fact something that you can hear, and that a good set of ears can pick up on different kinds of smiles. Joining us now from her office is the author of that study, Amy Drahota. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
I think you're smiling a little, aren't you?
I am. I'm smiling now, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, explain to us how you set up this study. I mean, did you have control questions, as they call them, and that sort of thing?
The study was carried out in three stages. The first stage involved recording speakers whilst they were smiling, but we didn't want the speakers to know that the study was about smiles at the time because we were interested in everyday expressions. Mm-hmm. So in order to do this, we carried out some rather bizarre interviews where we asked the speakers to always respond to our questions with the same answer, which was, I do in the summer. And then we built up the question schedule to gradually become more amusing, strange and bizarre in order to make them smile.
First question would be, do you eat oatmeal? I do in the summer. But the 10th question might be something like, do you go to Mars?
Yeah, something like that. Or do you ever go skinny dipping?
I do in the summer.
Yeah. So then after that had been done, we took the interview recordings and analysed the facial expressions that people had whilst they were speaking. Mm-hmm. And we picked up on three different types of smile for the purposes of the study. And these were a Duchenne smile, which is where the lips are drawn back, the cheeks are raised, and you get little crow's feet wrinkles around the eyes. Like
what is that called again?
Duchenne smile.
Duchenne?
Yep.
Okay.
Named after a physician.
A physician?
Yes.
Okay. I thought I could think of as Eddie Duchin, the piano player, but all right.
And then the second type of smile we looked at was the non-Duchenne smile, which is just like the Duchenne smile, but without the crow's feet wrinkles around the eyes.
So that's more of a half smile.
Might be a less intense version of the Duchenne, or it might be something completely different altogether. And the third type of smile that we looked at was the suppressed smile, which is where you're trying not to smile whilst you're speaking, perhaps because you're trying to remain serious, and you're, say, pulling your lips in or down as you speak. And then the fourth type of expression we had for the study was the no smile, where people just speak in normally. So we categorised all those expressions, and then we lifted just the voices from the recordings and played them back to a different set of listeners who had to work out whether or not people were smiling.
When you played those voices back,
yeah,
how did your control subjects do? Were they able to discern smiles after a while?
Most people were good at hearing the Duchenne smiles. That was the type of smile that people were most successful at.
Our producers here have been busy replicating.
Yes.
In this case, they've been trying to replicate at least some aspects of your study. So we're going to play some tape of someone who was on staff here. And I'm going to try and guess with your guidance, perhaps, if she's smiling or not.
Okay.
I do in the summer.
That doesn't sound like a smile to me.
Well, I thought I had a slight twinge of a smile in there, but...
They're nodding in the control room. You're right. And I know this person. All right, let's hear the next one.
I do in the summer.
Now, I would guess there's at least a non-Duchenne smile there.
Ooh. I don't know that I heard a smile in there.
You're right again, of course. You're the expert. Okay, we're going to hear another one.
I do in the summer.
Well, I, of course, am thoroughly intimidated at this point, so I'm not sure I want to even venture a guess. I'm going to say there's a Duchenne smile in there.
Yeah, I thought there was even a little sound of laughter in that one as well. Agree with you.
I'm told we were both right, although, to be honest, it was more a process of elimination with me than it, whereas you absolutely heard something. So with respect for what you've done, why? I mean, do we learn anything about how we communicate?
A lot of the research that's been done in this area in the past is focused on, they've used actors to simulate the different expressions. They haven't looked at different types of smiles and everyday expressions, which is what this research was really trying to home in on. But also, this research could have further applications, for example, in computer-simulated speech, making computerized voices sound more naturalistic, because they've done a lot of work on making computerized faces more expressive, but the voices still need more work.
Mr. Hoda, I'm moved to ask you a philosophical question, given your area of expertise. Do people smile because they're happy, or do they smile to make themselves feel happy?
Ooh. I imagine it works both ways.
Amy Drahota, University of Portsmouth, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Researchers have finally hit on the essential truth previously known to horror filmmakers. Clowns are not necessarily funny. Britain's University of Sheffield wanted to find a way to improve the children's wards of hospitals. They conducted a survey of 250 kids, and every single young patient disapproved of using clowns to cheer them up. The big painted smile didn't persuade them, and even some of the older kids found them scary.
Next Tuesday marks the 35th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. According to a study released today by the Alan Guttmacher Institute, the number of abortions in 2005 fell to near 30-year lows. NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner is here to talk about the new study. And Julie, what do the numbers show?
Well, the numbers showed that pretty much abortions went down by every conceivable measure. The actual number of abortions, 1.2 million in 2005, was the lowest number since 1976. The abortion rate, that's the percentage of the female population between age 15 and 44 that had an abortion that year, was 1.94%. That was the lowest since 1974. And the abortion ratio, which is the percent of pregnancies that end in abortion, was just over 1 in 5. That was also the lowest since 1974.
Now, were these numbers that came out a surprise?
Well, yes and no. All of these numbers have been declining for several years. They peaked in 1990. So it's really just the continuation of a trend. But this is the first time that the numbers have dropped all the way back to the levels that we saw just after Roe was decided.
Julie, what was the methodology for the study? This is done by the Alan Guttmacher Institute. And again, this was back in 2005, these numbers.
Yes, although they've been working on the study for the last 2.5 years. The Guttmacher Institute has been doing this study really pretty much since Roe was decided. This is the 14th study that they've done. It's considered really the gold standard by those on both sides, even though Guttmacher is considered more of a reproductive rights, pro-choice leaning organization. Everybody trusts these numbers. They're actually better numbers than the government is able to get, because several states, most notably California, doesn't collect abortion statistics. They actually send out surveys to every known abortion provider and work pretty hard to get some of those surveys back. I think that's part of what takes so long to get these numbers out.
Is there an indication within these numbers, Julie, of why the number of abortions is going down?
Well, it really is just a survey, so you can't tell that much from the numbers. You can tell who's doing abortions and how many abortions that they're doing. But that doesn't stop people on both sides of the debate from speculating. It could be fewer unintended pregnancies from better use of contraception or less unprotected sex. It could be state law restrictions that make it more difficult for women to get abortions. It could also be that women are carrying more unintended pregnancies to term because they don't have access to abortion because there are fewer providers.
Julie, the survey also tells us what percentage of abortions were carried out using the abortion pill.
Yes, it found that 13% of abortions are now being conducted not surgically but medically using the abortion pill, mostly the abortion pill RU486, which was approved in the year 2000. There's some mixed news on this score for people who had hoped that this would really expand access for women who live in areas where there is no surgical abortion provider. The survey found that 87% of counties in the U.S. where more than a third of women live do not have a surgical abortion provider. But what the survey found was that even though there's now a significant percentage of abortions being provided via the abortion pill, mostly that's going on in urban areas where there is also access to a surgical abortion provider. So it seems to be expanding the options for women, but not necessarily expanding the access to abortion.
NPR's Julie Rovner, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Scientists are gleefully rummaging through some treasures from outer space. NASA's Messenger spacecraft flashed past Mercury on Monday and took more than 1,200 pictures of the planet. It's still beaming them down to Earth. NPR's Richard Harris visited the project's lead scientist today.
The first thing you notice when you walk into Sean Solomon's office at the Carnegie Institution of Washington is the Mylar balloon in the shape of a giant champagne bottle. It celebrates Messenger's first big success at Mercury, the flyby. The next thing you notice is a Technicolor globe on the table of someplace that's definitely not Earth.
That's Mars.
Oh, that's Mars. Do you have one of Mercury?
Ah, Mercury is sad. Look at this.
Solomon picks up a dented brown orb the size of a giant grapefruit. It's a relic from long ago.
All the images came from Mariner 10. That's more than 30 years old. And half the globe is a complete blank because Mariner 10 only saw 45% of the surface.
That globe is on its way out. Monday, MESSENGER took breathtaking photos of a big chunk of Mercury, including a lot of terrain that's never been seen up close before.
In the words of Bob Strom, who is the only member of our science team who was also a participant on Mariner 10, this is a whole new planet.
Scientists haven't even finished downloading all the images yet, but the first glance is providing real food for thought.
Let's see.
Solomon pops open a photo on his computer screen. At first glance, Mercury looks like the moon, but it's actually quite different to a trained eye. He points out a dramatic fault that cuts a dark jag across the surface.
This is like the kind of fault that on the Earth you might see at the base of a great mountain range, or that the kind of fault that sometimes buried underneath basin sediments like in the Los Angeles area.
Here, it's an important clue about how Mercury formed. One thought is faults like this cropped up because Mercury actually shrank as it evolved. Solomon's also puzzled by dark splotches on the surface, splashed up by meteor impacts. But at the moment, he says his reaction to the new images is mostly in his heart, not his head.
It's a very strongly emotional reaction when even the scientific team sees these images for the first time, because it's like being a tourist in a place that no one has gone.
And the exploration has just begun. Solomon is also anxious to see whether there are signs of water ice in the permanently dark craters near the planet's pole. That, however, will have to wait till 2011, when MESSENGER returns to Mercury for a full year of observations. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Well, that letter caught our attention, so we called up Christine Pulliam, who is a colleague of Dr. Payne's at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, to find out a little more about how scientists explain what people might be seeing when they think they're seeing a UFO. Christine Pulliam, you have seen a superior mirage phenomenon?
Actually, everybody has. Anyone who has seen a sunrise or a sunset, the same phenomenon occurs to the sun every day and makes it appear to be above the horizon when it's actually slightly below it.
Well, the folks in Stephenville, Texas, whom Wade Goodwin spoke with, described seeing a very large red light up in the sky, 3,000 feet up, and then lights like strobe lights. How would those all be created? How would that illusion be created, if that's what it is?
It's hard to say for sure since I haven't seen it, but there are a lot of natural phenomena that can make things look unusual in the sky. We get a lot of phone calls from people who see a bright light on the horizon that seems to be shimmering, dancing around, and changing colors, and they think it might be an artificial object. But then we look it up on our planetarium software and find out that, no, actually the planet Venus was on the horizon at the time.
How is it that on one night many people could see this sort of superior mirage, but not see it and on any other night? Why would it happen on one particular day as opposed to happening every week or every month? We do see the sunrise every day and every...
That's right.
Yes, but not this.
Something like this, it would have to be unusual weather conditions, something where it's cooler air close to the surface and much warmer air high up.
So as for the explanation that some of our listeners prefer, which is that just a courtesy call from Venus or something like that, or some distant galaxy, no point to rush to any such inference from this, you're saying?
Right. I would say that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And if somebody really thinks that it's alien visitors or hyperdimensional travelers, they need to come up with a better explanation than eyewitness reports.
Well, Christine Pulliam, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Christine Pulliam of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
You don't have to be an expert to email us. Go to our website, npr.org, and click on Contact Us at the top of the page.